Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Professor Stuart Hart, co-director of the Sustainable Innovation MBA at the University of Vermont's Grossman School of Business, one of the world's most radical and pioneering MBA programs, which embeds sustainability deep into every business discipline. Stu is one of the world's top authorities on the implications of environment and poverty for business strategy. His book, Capitalism at the Crossroads, first published in 2005, was selected by Cambridge University as one of the top 50 books on sustainability of all time. Bloomberg Businessweek have called him one of the founding fathers of the base of the pyramid economic theory. Outside of academia, Stu consults widely as the founder and president of Enterprise for a Sustainable World, and he is also founding director of the Emergent Institute in Bangalore, India. I spoke to Stu online from his home in Vermont. So Stuart, welcome to Change Hackers.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I'm so excited about this conversation. You've been someone I've admired for many years now, and you're far too modest to call yourself a rock star professor, but that's exactly what you are. You've been working on this area of corporate sustainability and related topics for, well, pretty much before anyone else was, and have led a movement within academia towards taking a much greater interest in sustainability. The first thing I want to do is explore how you got into this in the first place.
You know, I had a fairly unremarkable, somewhat, you know, idyllic 19, because I was born in the early 50s, right? Kind of the classic kind of middle-class American story, you know, upstate Western New York. So fairly unremarkable from that point of view. In other words, I wasn't born particularly poor or rich. You know, I was sort of a classic middle-class, you know, 50s kid. But within that context, Western New York, you know, was not a real pretty place back then, right? Between, you know, the Buffalo Steel Mills and, you know, in Rochester, where I spent a lot of time, had Eastman Kodak, which, you know, sort of viewed as this, you know, high-tech company, but it was really a chemical manufacturing operation, right? They made film. I didn't know that then, right? But I would say some of the early experiences had to do with, you know, just like, wondering why, you know, when you go outside, you know, like even outside to play or go out on a back porch, that, you know, you would have to like bring a towel in order to, you know, clean off the porch chairs because of, you know, the soot or just pollution in general.
But I guess to begin with, you didn't think that was anything out of the ordinary. That was your reality you'd been born into, I guess.
It was the reality, but I mean, I do have a recollection of wondering, you know, why is this? Like, why is this going on? And when I got a little bit older, you know, like old enough where I would actually maybe ask a question, you know, like maybe in my early teens, the answer typically from everyone, right? It wasn't just my parents. I think this was just sort of the dominant logic of the time. The answer was, well, that's the smell of money, kid. So get used to it. Right. I mean, you have to make some sacrifices in order to have prosperity. And I still remember that answer I didn't find particularly satisfying. And it's probably something that was, you know, it was close to the inception point of my kind of interest in this. And but, you know, I was kind of like the all-American kid in high school. I played three sports, you know, was a good student, you know, won the student athlete award in my high school class, you know, played basketball in college. But also at the same time, it's like late 60s, early 70s, right? So it didn't take long before the kind of the spirit of the times got to me, right? And so early on in college, you know, I ran into a professor and you know, took a class. He was a geology professor, but he was teaching a class in, you know, kind of in environment, right? And in environmental impact and impact assessment. And that just completely turned my head around, right? I hadn't really thought about it in those terms before. And then that, you know, initially I thought I was going to be pre-med because that's what, you know, everyone, that was sort of the, you know, that was, if you were going to be a science type, that's what you did, right? And So I shifted off of that track and, you know, became a bio-geo major. And so just loaded up on that kind of coursework. And it was, you know, that was the anti-war movement. It was the inception of the environmental movement. You know, the National Environmental Policy Act had just passed. I learned all about environmental impact statements, which were brand new at that point in time. And, you know, sort of gradually became convinced that, you know, corporations were the enemy. And they probably were, you know, at that point in time. Enough that, you know, as I got to my junior and senior year and began to think what I was going to do next, I came to know, you know, through some of my professors. I was at the University of Rochester as an undergrad, right? So my hometown, right? And, you know, learned about, you know, these programs like at Yale, you know, had a School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. They added the name Environmental Studies onto the end of it. So I looked into that and I decided that that's what I was going to do. So I applied, got accepted, and, you know, right out of college, enrolled in the, you know, got married, you know, because that's also what you did back then, right? You know, you had a girlfriend and you were going to move away and live with her. And so I went to Yale, right, and enrolled in the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. You know, looked pretty different back then compared to the way I look now. if you were to go to New Haven and go to Sage Hall, where they have pictures of all the graduating classes, you would probably have some difficulty picking me out in that photo. I graduated in 1976 from that program. You know, full beard, you know, pretty long hair. You'd have some difficulty identifying me. That was a great program. It also just reaffirmed my conviction that corporations were the enemy. And so left that. Wasn't quite sure exactly what I wanted to do, but, you know, figured that it was going to be in the NGO space somewhere, you know, and then graduated and didn't have a job. So my wife and I, you know, decided that we just took, you know, like 6 months off and drove around the country. That was an amazing trip, you know, like we went, it was a cross country and back, you know, pretty much covered the entire country over 6 months, you know, and camped as we went. And wherever it was, where we knew someone, we stayed with them. That was quite a trip, right? That it's kind of one of those things you do maybe. And I still remember when I was graduating, the acting dean of the forestry school at that time was a guy named Garth Voigt, who was a very famous soil scientist and had studied with Aldo Leopold. Mm-hmm. If you know your conservation, You know the name Aldo Leopold from the Sam County Almanac. Voigt was one of his students at Wisconsin. And he asked me after graduation, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I think, you know, my wife and I are we're just going to go and take a, you know, cross country trip out west. And he said, wow, that's a great idea. You'll find that will be one of the most memorable things that you do in your life. And you'll never have the opportunity to do anything like that again until you retire. And here I am sitting here talking to you right now, and I'm 65, and he was right. he was absolutely right. But that was a remarkable year. And you know, I got back, started looking for a job, moved back to Rochester, and then got hooked up, you know, through Yale with a guy who graduated from there with a PhD and went to this little NGO think tank place in upstate New York outside of Albany called, at the time, very sexist, Institute on Man and Science.
You wouldn't get away with that now.
Yeah, it'd be harder to get away with that now. But they had a program on community renewal and development, and then they had this guy named Gordon Enk, E-N-K, you know, so turned out to be another one of my really important mentors, had started a program that was called Economic and Environmental Studies. And, you know, so this is, you know, like 1976, 77 timeframe. So, you know, he invited me to come for an interview. We hit it off. He hired me, right? And I went there. And that was an amazing, you know, just kind of happened. And he was a PhD and with a focus on resource economics, but had done his dissertation on the forest products industry, sort of strategic decision making in the forest products industry around, you know, what we would now call sustainable forestry. Mm-hmm. And that was an eye opener for me. We were doing work on, there was a big grant, you know, where we looked at the state level environmental impact statement laws that were coming on after the federal law. And then there was a big project with the Carter administration Department of Energy that was called Decentralized Solar Technology Assessment. Right? So I got involved. So this just opened up a whole set of new doors that I hadn't really thought about before. And with Gordon in particular, you know, he wasn't just knee-jerk anti-corporate, right? I mean, he was much more reflective because his dissertation involved interviewing senior executives in most of the major forest products companies. And so this kind of got me thinking, you know, that, you know, like, okay, so we spent the last 2 years like studying these laws, and generally speaking, the environmental impact statement process just became a way to delay or try to stop projects. Not a real positive vision. So I began to ask myself, is this really what I want to do with my life? You know, like just like spend my life stopping projects. Granted, a lot of the projects deserve to be stopped, but it wasn't something that really inspired me to want to do that forever. And Gordon began to kind of implant in me the sense that, you know, because I was effectively doing research, but didn't really know it necessarily. And he said, have you ever thought about a PhD program? And I hadn't, right, at the time. And I said, no. And he began to suggest some, and I began to look into them. And, you know, lo and behold, a couple of years later, I apply and end up, I got accepted at Cornell in Michigan and went to the Michigan doctoral program. That was an interdepartmental doctoral program focused on planning and strategy. It was before the business school really had much of a presence from a research point of view. Back then, business schools were still sort of just teaching, you know, they were teaching mills. They got a lot of, you know, during the 70s, they took a lot of abuse, business schools, probably deservedly so, because they were that, right? They were, mm-hmm. they were viewed as outliers on university campuses because they weren't really research oriented. They were,
right,
you know, hired accountants and consultants that taught the classes and that kind of thing.
So what was drawing you away from the technical side towards more sort of strategy management?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just, as I got further into this work where it was really about stopping these projects, right? And you look more at the proposals. They could come from government agencies. They could come from corporations that are doing these, have to do these impact statements. You know, and I began to ask myself, like, why would people, seemingly smart, you know, people in government, in business, propose such seemingly destructive projects in the first place? Like, what? Why would they do that? Right? And Gordon also kind of, I think, sparked my imagination there to, you know, that. It's sort of the five whys. You ask, you know, if you ask enough why questions, eventually you come to, you know, questions around strategy and strategic decision making, right? And so I started reading in that area, and then ultimately that's what I did my doctoral work in. You know, it had to do with before Ed Freeman, you know, kind of wrote the stakeholder management book, you know, that established a whole field. My dissertation focused on the effect or impact that consulting with what we would now call stakeholders, the effect that that had on decision quality, right? But so what happens? Do you make better, more informed, more imaginative, more creative? What impact does engagement with outside voices have on decision quality? So it was organizational behavior, you know, organizational psychology, organizational change kind of dissertation. And I got hooked up with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan.
I guess at the time, the number of organizations you could study that were doing that would have been pretty thin.
Pretty well, I was able to leverage the work I had done at the Institute on Man and Science, you know, that we were working on a number of these projects. And that included, you know, kind of some in-depth knowledge of the proposed projects themselves. So I was able to go back and study them, right, and get access to them. And so that was a huge benefit. And then that kind of one thing led to another. I end up at the Institute for Social Research as a assistant research scientist for a couple of years, working on, you know, on projects that have to do with kind of technology assessment and organizational change, but never really being entirely satisfied with that, you know, because I was still interested in environment. And while there was some of that happening there, you know, it wasn't something that I saw, you know, long-term that I wanted. It was all soft money. You'd have to, you know, it's all writing grants and contracts, which was interesting to learn about. The Institute was that too, right? So I became somewhat adept at writing grants and contracts. But this is now the mid-80s that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And this is the time when business schools began to really take off, when they began, you know, they got a lot of pressure in the 70s about just being teaching mills. And in the 80s, they became more academic. You know, so there was a huge wave of hiring PhD-trained people as faculty in business schools in the mid-80s. So, you know, I hung my shingle out, you know, went on the market, had a bunch of offers, including one right at Michigan at the business school there. So decided to stay, right? I probably had a half a dozen offers from other places. You know, PhD-trained faculty with dissertations that were relevant, right? That was who they were after.
And so, at that time, was your orientation still adversarial towards business, or were you starting to become more pragmatic through the influence of others you had been working with?
Started to become more pragmatic. You know, by then, you know, was not completely opposed, still skeptical, but now all of a sudden, I'm joining the faculty, right, of the University of Michigan Business School as a professor of strategy, right, and truth be told, and this was not me alone, right? I think most of the, you know, kind of fresh out, I mean, I was 2 years out from my PhD, but I didn't have any teaching experience to speak of, just immediately got thrown in the core, right? So first year there, I got thrown into teaching the core course in corporate strategy with another rookie, and the guy who headed it up had been there 2 years. So, you know, needless to say, we didn't exactly, you know, set a record.
As long as you're one step ahead of the guys you're teaching this.
Exactly. So that was a huge learning curve, and we kind of cratered the course, you know. So, you know, that was probably one of the worst set of teaching evaluations that had ever been demonstrated, you know, at the business. So that when you do that, that gets the attention of the department chairs and the deans. So they had to take corrective action. They couldn't keep doing the core course and strategy that way. So they bring in the big gun to take over as course head the next year, and that big gun was C.K. Prahalad. So C.K., you know, had been there for now already 6-7 years, you know, had tenure, had already written some things that put him on the map, you know, sort of in a pretty significant way with Gary Hamel, and he was a great teacher, right? So C.K. became the course head that next year. That's really where I learned how to teach, you know, was from CK, because, you know, PhD training, you don't learn anything about teaching, you learn about research. So that was, again, a huge learning experience. And I also got to know him a bit as well, and also came to maybe understand and appreciate his perspective better than I had, because he already had a reputation, you know, being this kind of big shot consultant with companies, you know, but the academics in the school were suspicious of him because he spent too much time with, you know, kind of practice leaders when he should be writing journal articles. That was already becoming the dominant culture of business schools. You know, it's now gone so far out of bounds that direction that, you know, where really it's about a journal publishing as the primary metric of success. It was already headed that direction. But CK came in kind of before that, right? And he would have been, and he did, he'd been the first one to say then, had he come in when I came in, he probably never would have gotten tenure. Right. So, but he had tenure already. And, you know, I learned a lot about his perspective, which was, you know, like as an academic, they don't pay you enough, right, to just sort of like buckle under and do what you shouldn't just salute the flag and take orders. There is this thing called intellectual freedom that you should take seriously. And I was, you know, I was being pressured already I had this dissertation work that I'd done on strategic decision making. Just chunk that out into publishable articles and A journals, teach the courses, get good course evaluations, you know, just do that and you'll get tenure, right? And a lot of pressure that way. And I remember, you know, being increasingly dissatisfied. I wasn't, you know, just teaching that core course. It was interesting. I mean, I learned a lot after the first year with CK, but I kept doing it. It wasn't, you know, I can't say that I, you know, was emotionally committed to it, you know, or passionate about it. I learned how to do it and do it well. And then, you know, just like writing these journal articles on, you know, in an area of strategic decision making that was of interest, but it wasn't my passion. And I kept trying to bring environment in, right? This is like 87, 88 timeframe. And I kept getting it shoved right back in my face with comments like, if you keep trying to do this, this will end your career, right? That this is just not relevant. For a business school to, you know, like, I know you have this background, but just go back, write your papers, teach your courses, and that's the best way you can build your career. And one of the few voices to the contrary was CK. saying, wow, like, you got this weird background. If you don't decide to just kind of go for it, you'll look back in 20 or 25 years and you'll never forgive yourself. Right? Again, they don't pay you enough in, you know, as an academic to not do what you're intellectually passionate about. You have to pursue that. And there were maybe two other people at the time that had gone down a similar path, and they both already had tenure. Those people were Tom Gladman, who was at NYU at the time, and Paul Srivastava, who had been at NYU and was then at Bucknell. And so I sought them out, got to know them, you know, and they provided a little bit of support. But I remember making a very conscious decision in the year 1990 that come hell or high water, I was just going to devote the rest of my professional career to this connection between business and environment. And I just didn't care what happened. I made a very conscious choice to do that. And about the same time, and
did you have enough agency at the time within faculty to be able to make that without it becoming totally career limiting?
No, not at the time. Not at the time. It was a fairly suicidal decision to make at the time. but shortly thereafter, something happened that kind of opened a door that I didn't, you know, I couldn't have anticipated. But it was, so there's a new dean that came in at the business school, you know, a younger dean that was more in my age bracket. And the same thing at the School of Natural Resources and Environment at Michigan, because I had had in my doctoral work, I had spent time at the School of Natural Resources and Environment and knew the people over there pretty well. It turned out the guy who came as dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment had been at Yale, right? So, and Yale was one of the first to create a joint chair between the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies that I had graduated from and Yale's business school, which is called the School of Organization and Management. And this guy named Gary Brewer had held that chair, the Weyerhaeuser chair. And then he came to Michigan as the dean of the School of Natural Resources and Environment. So he had a natural proclivity to want to build a relationship with the business school, you know, sought out the new dean of the business school, and they hit it off, right? And so this suddenly opened a window for me, which didn't exist before. And of course, Gary Brewer, you know, knew of this idea of a dual degree. And so that provided me the opportunity I needed. So I just went after it and, you know, then just became the champion for the creation of this new dual degree program between the business school and the School of Natural Resources and Environment that at the time was called the Corporate Environmental Management Program. This is before sustainability, right?
So I'm curious. I mean, you know, I can see how the change of leadership in a hierarchical, you know, sort of authoritarian structure might work. But in a business school or an academic environment, it's like becoming the dean's like herding cats.
Yes.
What was the reaction of faculty when there was this sort of shift of the trajectory from the new dean and this newfound collaboration and, you know, with the environmental sciences and there was an appetite for your kind of work? There must have been a lot of kickback from the rest of the faculty.
That didn't change.
Who'd been naysayers previously.
Exactly. That didn't change very much. I mean, there had always been, you know, a handful, you know, three, four other faculty that had some interest in, the, you know, in this domain, as you would always expect, right? There would be a small number of people off a base of, you know, 120 faculty. There were a few others, you know, there are two or three, four other faculty. So, you know, and I knew them. But otherwise, as you suggest, it didn't change very much. But what did change was the fact that the deans decided, you know, amongst themselves, to move ahead with this new dual degree. And they had to have a faculty member kind of champion it. So I just absolutely dove after it, right? And got to know, you know, Gary Brewer quite well as the dean of the School of Natural Resources Environment. And that's what really opened the window for me. Now, most people said that this is like a really stupid move for you to make. You like to become a program developer and administrator and you don't have tenure. This is almost certainly going to be like really damaging to your career.
Because it's taking you away from research.
Exactly. And I just didn't care, right? But because everything I was doing at the time was now focused intellectually on this question too. So that took a little time, right? There was a little bit of a gap in publishing because you have to sort of now invest in this new domain. I'm beginning to write in this area. And then we get this program up and running, and the early set of students that came into it were fantastic, right? And I'm still in touch with several of the original Kemp group, right? And they're all in their 40s now, and some of them are CEOs. So it's quite amazing that way. But, you know, and we had corporate support. You know, you had Dow right there in Michigan, that because this is the early days of eco-efficiency. Now that's suddenly on the agenda. That's business relevant. You have CEOs telling business school deans this should be part of the business curriculum. You know, with DuPont and Dow and 3M and so forth, you know, they were the champions of eco-efficiency and pollution prevention at the time. So now suddenly this adds, you know, the dean of the business school is now much more positive about it because he's getting positive feedback from key corporate, you know, constituencies. And the whole thing begins to really take off, right? And the program now is up and running. We got money. It's successful. The students are great. It's a three-year dual degree. I'm beginning to write in this area. And then I go up for tenure. And I'm denied tenure.
And it was all going so well.
And the reason I'm denied tenure, I'm told, is because, you know, it looks like I'm kind of a dilettante topic shifter, right? I mean, like, you know, you haven't dug a deep hole, you know, you've done this work in strategic decision making and organizational change, and now suddenly you're writing this stuff on in business and environment. Like, what, you know, who are you? What do you, you know, what's your field? So that's the reason I'm told that I'm denied tenure. But at the same time, the dean says, we'd like you to stick around and continue to run the corporate environmental management program. In other words, you're denied tenure, but we want you to stay, which almost never happens, right? If you're denied tenure somewhere, you leave typically. So I decided to, I said yes to that, but kind of under protest. I didn't see myself as, you know, a long-term kind of career off tenure track administrator, which is sort of what, if you bought into that, that's what you would become. But I said yes. So I stayed on because the students were great. I taught a course called Strategies for Environmental Management. And I taught another course, brand new, called Strategies for Sustainable Development. That was my teaching. Everything I did, you know, like, you know, under, you know, kind of given CK's guidance, we're out there working with companies, learning a lot about what companies are doing and starting to write about that. I'm now off the tenure track, so nobody expects me to produce any intellectual content. But it's during that period of time when I got knocked off the tenure track that I wrote the stuff that really put me on the map. You know, I wrote a piece, an academic piece called The Natural Resource-Based View of the Firm, that's now become probably one of the most cited, if not the most cited academic pieces in this broad field of sustainable business. And then from that came another piece that was in HBR, and it was CK that made the introduction to the editor at Harvard Business Review, that sort of sprung from the academic piece, and it was published as a piece called Beyond Greening, Strategies for a Sustainable World. And it was, again, among the first articles in Harvard Business Review that related to this topic, right? So I didn't really expect that it would actually be accepted there, but it was. And then, much to my surprise, it went on to win the McKinsey Award that year as the best article in Harvard Business Review. And that's what opened the floodgates. You know, from that single piece got more citation, more attention, you know, quickly, right, than everything else I had done in sum total to that point.
There are people that seek greatness and there are people that have greatness thrust upon them.
So suddenly now there's companies calling me, you know, I'm getting all these inquiries. It's, you know, that, and that obviously helps the program a lot, right? And I, you know, I continued to write, right? And pieces are being put in this area. And now, strangely enough, other business schools start to get interested in me, right? So I'm getting inquiries from other business schools to come as a faculty member, you know, with tenure.
Well, I guess by virtue of getting into HBR and the plaudits around it, they'd start to getting positive feedback from businesses in their networks.
Yeah, the HBR piece provided, you know, just all kinds of visibility out in the world, right? Which actually doesn't do much for you academically, right? It was the academic pieces that I was writing that were getting the attention.
It's the practitioner audience for HBR,
isn't
it?
It is, right? So, but like the Natural Resource-Based View of the Firm was in the Academy of Management Review, you know, that's an A journal. And I continued to, there were other A journal pieces that I wrote, you know, so, and no one was expecting that I would write that, right? I was under no pressure to write that because I was off the tenure track. So I found, I look back at it now, and it's one of those things where, you know, what looks like a really dark day, you know, like you get turned down for tenure and you get bumped off and you're seen as this administrator and, you know, sort of like a leper. Nobody wants to talk to you, right? But they just left me alone, right? And we had money, great students, access to companies. That gave me sort of insights and that allowed me to write pieces that really mattered, right? That made a real impact. And now all of a sudden, other academic business schools start to get interested in me. I start to get offers. And one of them was particularly attractive at the University of North Carolina. And I took it. So I left and went, you know, as a tenured professor at Kenan Flagler. They were interested in starting a center. So we built up a center for sustainable enterprise there. Had doctoral students, you know, there that now have gone on, you know, and are, you know, including a guy named Mark Milstein, who I later hired at Cornell because I left UNC and I was recruited by Cornell. Sam Johnson, you know, of S.C. Johnson, is the Johnson School of Cornell, yeah, gave an endowment gift to start a center and endowed a chair. So Cornell recruited me in 2003. And you know, so I had doctoral students like Mark Milstein and a guy named Ted London at UNC. And Ted, you know, kind of went back to Michigan because Michigan had created this thing called the William Davidson Institute, focused on emerging and frontier economies. So Ted got hired and he built up a program around base of the pyramid at the time. Because about the time, right, it's about the time, you know, just before I'm at UNC, just after I left Michigan, and before I go to Cornell, that Prahalad and I start writing this piece called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. Mm. And that came from just a very interesting kind of happenstance, you know, that after I did the Beyond Greening piece in HBR, CK and a guy named Ken Lieberthal, who is a faculty member at Michigan, also a China specialist, wrote a piece that was ultimately published, you know, in HBR that was called The End of Corporate Imperialism. That was the title at HBR. It was originally entitled something like Competing for Opaque Markets or something like that. But, you know, what you discover is practitioner journals are very good at creative titling. But CK gave me a draft of that to look at. And it was about, you know, how you can't just copy paste strategy from the triad, you know, US, Europe, and Japan when it comes to China and India. And mm-hmm. he had made the introduction for me at HBR about Beyond Greening. And already in the Beyond Greening piece, if you go back and look at that, you know, that it, even then, right, in 96, 97, it was clear that just sort of greening strategies, you know, pollution prevention and product stewardship strategies in Europe and the US and Japan weren't going to get it done. We're going to have to figure out how to address the developing world from a sustainable development point of view. So I had a strategy in that paper called A Strategy for Sustainable Development. And, you know, so CK was aware of that. And when he and Ken wrote this piece about you can't just copy paste in China and India, the comment I made was, well, that's great, but your strategies you're talking about really are about the, you know, sort of more the rising middle class market. What about, you know, you know, in China and India, the real problem are the rural masses, right? That at the time, right, that was the real problem. So that kind of got set us on a path of thinking about, wow, you know, no one has really written a paper that makes a case for why corporations should be interested in poverty as a business opportunity. You know, there are NGOs that are doing this and, you know, and there's, you know, the emerging field of microfinance, but nobody's made a case why the corporate world should be interested in this. So that's what kind of sparked our imagination around this bottom of the pyramid idea. And we went on, wrote a draft of that in like 1998 before I left for UNC. And it was called Raising the Bottom of the Pyramid. That was the working title, Strategies for Sustainable Development, you know, after the colon. And nobody would publish it, right? I mean, we floated it, you know, at HBR. They were kind of hot and cold. Nobody would publish it. So I left, went to UNC. We continued to work on it like 98, 99, 2000, 2001. Then 9/11 happens. And within a month of 9/11, there's a new journal called Strategy Plus Business, which is now pretty well established. And they came after it, right? Because it had become kind of an underground paper. Already companies were starting to pursue this. So CK was busily kind of working with a bunch. So was I. We had started something called the Base of the Pyramid Learning Lab at UNC in the year 2000. CEMEX had started their Patrimony Oi program. Hindustan Lever, you know, was kind of active in India, even in the
Yeah, Shakti Girls.
Before Shakti, you know, this was just sort of their wheel kind of early, you know, their affordable detergent product stuff. So already, you know, that we were beginning to work with companies on that. And then suddenly this paper gets published by, they come after it and they take the paper and they come back with their title, which was The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. That was not our title, right? That was the editor's title. And I remember, you know, having real reservations about that title because of everything it conjures up. But I rationalized it in my own mind, you know, as, you know, fortune, the word fortune has a double meaning, you know, it also can be a foretelling. But of course, you know, that paper, I'd say, accomplished its objective, which was to be provocative. It certainly got, it created a lot of interest, you know, out there in the corporate world and resulted in a lot of experimentation, which was great. But it also attracted a lot of negative attention that this is just about selling cheap stuff to poor people and taking what little money they have, right? That there was that whole kind of reaction against it, which was great, you know, because it just forced that discussion even more, right, out into the open. And so pretty much all the work that I'd done, you know, after I went to UNC and went to Cornell then was, you know, to address those shortcomings that if we're going to really get after the challenge of global sustainability, we have to figure out how to serve and lift the underserved at the base of the pyramid in a way that makes sense from their perspective. So the whole idea around co-creation and creating with the base of the pyramid, and then also the idea of disruptively innovating new regenerative and clean technology starting in the base of the pyramid, because you can't just lift the base with the same old kind of take, make, waste approach as we had, you know, in the industrial world. And so all of my work since then has been focused on that intersection, you know, that I've called the Green Leap, you know, that for the past 10, 15 years, that's been my main focus. So, you know, it was at Cornell, we stood the center up there, feel good about that. But it also then became clear that that was at the time about as far as they wanted to go. You know, we had a center established, we had, you know, like a little immersion, we called it in the MBA program. But you know, I'm now kind of getting well into my 50s, right, and still have a little bit of an itch and a fire in my belly to really make things happen, not just kind of rep year in and year out more or less the same thing. So for a variety of reasons, decided to do phased retirement and go emeritus. We moved back to Ann Arbor, you know, because we loved it there, you know, like our kids were born there and we lived there a long time, had a friendship network. And, you know, we started this little company called Enterprise for a Sustainable World that was focused on this transformative kind of sustainability that I just talked about, the Green Leap. How do we get to tomorrow's inherently clean regenerative technology and at the same time build a more inclusive economy, right, through base of the pyramid strategies? That was the focus of ESW from a consulting point of view. And then we'd also been building up this thing called the BOP Global Network, which started with our BOP Learning Lab, but then produced a bunch of other spin-off innovation centers. And by 09 or so, there were 15 to 18 of them. So we thought, wow, maybe somebody would be willing to put a little money in to help us connect these together and build a global network. So Natura did that. And so we launched the BOP Global Network about that time. And it's now closer to 40 labs and innovation centers. We do convenings, regional and global. Next BOP Global Network Summit is in April of this year, 2018, in India.
Which I'll be joining you at.
As you know, you'll be there.
Yeah.
and I figured that was what I was going to do, right? To kind of, that was going to be the final chapter of really trying to go for impact, you know? But then, and this will be the last part of the story, I think maybe one of the takeaways here is that having a grand plan generally doesn't work so well, right? I mean, you can have I would say that I always had kind of a North Star. You know, I knew directionally where I wanted to head, but you never know exactly what the appropriate next step is going to be until it appears. And the key is being open to seeing the next step. It would be easy to just kind of write off a lot of things that came my way as bad for my career or inappropriate or bad moves. But what appeared at the time as bad moves turned out to be so important, right? And so here we are back in Ann Arbor, and I get a call one day from just a complete set of strangers I didn't know. It was a set of three or four kind of Indian business people who were interested in starting a new institute in India, focused on, you know, this sort of inclusive and sustainable entrepreneurship and business development. So one thing led to another, and, you know, they decided to back the creation of this. So I spent a lot of time in India, you know, between 2011, 2012, 2013, in, you know, kind of conceptualizing with colleagues and standing up a whole new institute called the Emergent Institute, which resulted in, a training curriculum for entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs, and involved one of my old friends and colleagues, Sanjay Sharma, who had had made his name in Canada as a sustainable business scholar, but then became a dean at Concordia in Montreal, dean of the business school there, Canada's largest business school. He got involved. We're spending time in India together, and as we're working on Emergent, and then he's telling me that this dean job came open at the University of Vermont, right, which is just down the road from Montreal. You know, Concordia is a huge business, like 400 faculty. You know, he's telling me that he's thinking about doing this, right? And I didn't really know much about the University of Vermont Business School at the time, but it became evident that, you know, what he had in his mind was, wow, this is a place, because it's not a well-established business school, where you could actually be a disruptor, where you could, it could become a platform for launching the business school of tomorrow, truly innovating, as opposed to, you know, a piece that we wrote where we've used this metaphor, saddlebag sustainability. Sanjay and I have written a piece called Beyond Saddlebag Sustainability and Business Education, you know, because most of what passes for sustainable business and business schools is a couple of elective courses in the second year, you know, but the core remains the same. The first year stuff is largely the same. So at Vermont, so he took the job as dean. And, you know, if you fast forward, what you will find is that as a transformational leader, he has completely transformed that business school. It's now the Grossman School of Business, has brought resources, has completely altered and changed the focus and refocused it on business for a sustainable world. And one of his first moves was to abolish what was kind of a small and shrinking MBA program that was losing money, and then to challenge the faculty to create a new one, which ultimately approved the creation of a new MBA program focused on sustainability and entrepreneurship and innovation. He's telling me this as we're sitting in India, you know, that it's now been unanimously approved. Would you be interested in joining, maybe helping us kind of frame this out? So I started going as an adjunct consultant. One thing led to another. Sanjay raises money. And lo and behold, here I am, an endowed chaired professor there. And we have, you know, developed from scratch a completely new MBA program that we view as business education for the 21st century. Clean sheet redesign of the MBA. AACSB accredited, you know, so a completely new transformational curriculum, but also accredited with, you know, how do we find the right people, and then how do we launch them effectively out into the world? And I continue with the ESW Enterprise for a Sustainable World work with the BOP Global Network, because practicum projects are a huge part of this new MBA program, and the whole thing just feeds itself. So, you know, here I am now 65, soon to be 66 years old, and I don't know that I really want to slow down that much.
It sounds to me like you're just getting going. You know, I mean, just you're in your stride, and you. So there's, I mean, it's been fascinating listening, and I've got so many questions. There's a number of things that stand out for me. So I think first of all, there's this thing around being, even though you might not have been able to initially clearly define it, what you refer to as the North Star, but, you know, there was a sense of where you want to head. There was no grand plan when you were 23.
No, not at all.
Looking ahead, you know, but there also seemed to be, combined with that, an instinct for taking the road less traveled.
Yeah.
For doing what you believe to be the right thing, regardless of what the consequences were.
Yep.
And that seems to have cropped up numerous times as you've gone along.
Yep.
The way you've weighed things up and then made a decision has always been informed heavily by your sense of, is this taking me closer to my goals?
I think that's it. That's it. You know, and sort of having the, it sounds trite, you know, but it is sort of having the courage of your convictions and not being, if I try to be personally reflective, you know, just sort of on my own personality, you know, I think at some level I'm not a joiner, right? In other words, it's easy to kind of get, you get comfortable, right? You get into an organization, you do work, you get accepted there, and it's comfortable to just remain there. You know people, they affirm, the work you're doing year in and year out. You know, there might be some career progression within that setting. And, you know, and it's easy to just then look back and it's 10 or 20 years later, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with, you know, with that trajectory. But for me, at least, I found that, you know, there's a certain level of impatience, you know, or with, you know, I just, it's hard for me to drink the Kool-Aid that way. You know, I always, you know, when I get to know, when, once you get inside and get to know a place, then you see all of its warts and it makes you want to try to change them. And if you're able to get traction to do that, then that motivates you to want to stay and continue. But if you find that you just start running your head into a wall, then that's motivation to move on. And I think that's kind of been my pattern, you know, over the course of my career, you know, and until now, like I, you know, when we were talking about this a little earlier, the Vermont program does not present many of those stone walls, right? So it's, you know, it's a very inviting, you know, the whole premise is on being a MBA disruptor and creating tomorrow's business. That's what I've always wanted to do, right? And you know, it's typically not possible in most institutional settings.
But equally, for someone of your standing academically, it's again a road less traveled. You know, the easy thing to do would be to go to one of the elite institutions and enjoy your last few years, you know, as a working academic. You know, you've chosen to go, because again, it's about the mission. I wonder how much of it's about legacy. Do you have kind of conversations with yourself around when you're going to be sat in a rocking chair, you know, in your dotage, thinking like, am I proud of the time I spent?
Yes. Yeah. And I guess the way I think about that is in thinking about, you know, we'll call it the North Star. You know, if I look back, let's say in another 10 years, then I still see, you know, thriving. I see a thriving Herb Institute at Michigan, the Herb Institute for Sustainable Global Enterprise. I see the Center for Sustainable Enterprise at UNC. I see the Center for Sustainable Global Enterprise at Cornell. I see right now, and what I hope will continue to be a thriving MBA program, Sustainable Innovation MBA program at Vermont, with, you know, with students and faculty and companies that have been attached, and that's how you have impact, right? And so I think there's legacy is part of it, but I think it has to do with creating something that has staying power that will be enduring beyond you.
And there seems to me also is that there's an instinct there around being at the front end of the wave. Never been a bandwagon person, always enjoyed being a pioneer. But it must give you some satisfaction to see the bandwagon coming along and actually, you know, the idea of mainstreaming, even if it's saddlebagging, but, you know, eventually that will change. But, you know, there's an increased level of interest, well, massively increased level of interest, not just amongst educators, but also amongst the business community in taking a much more responsible, sustainable approach. That must give you a huge amount of satisfaction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It does. And it feels good to feel like I maybe had some small, you know, impact on that, you know, that feels good. I mean, that's what I hope that I would be able to try to have some impact on, right? And I think maybe I have in some small way. So that's all really positive. I feel really good about that. But also just, you know, to recognize, just looking at myself, being self-reflective, you know, I think because it's not going to come out right. You know, in some ways I get bored easily, right? In other words, once you've sort of cracked the code on something and it's standing up, then, you know, the thought of just kind of running it, you know, tweaking it and running it for the, you know, looking into the future just doesn't appeal to me that much. You know, and that's just me, right? I think that.
I think a lot of listeners will relate to that.
But I mean, some people are exactly the opposite, right? They're totally uncomfortable during this sort of ambiguous, uncertain period when you don't know whether it's going to work or not. and they're attracted to something that's been established, and now you can get in there and really run it and grow it. And I know myself well enough to know that I'm the person that thrives on the front end.
Stuart, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, Tony, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.